When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Revisiting Clinton and Trump in high school. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
One theory about why the two leading candidates for president aren't widely accepted, because they're the same type of people who weren't well-liked in high school.
On the travel front, three little-known rules that could save you at the airport when things go awry with your flight.
On the fashion front, understanding the Hollywood trend of white sneakers and the unusual efforts to keep them clean.
And how it's more than just the 1% who are better off than ever after the recession.
Since 1979, the number of people earning the equivalent of what's $100,000 today has more than doubled. It's gone from about 13% of the population to about 29% of the population.
Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Zumbrun on the expanding upper middle class. He's here in about 10 minutes. Well, if all the world is a recreation of high school, then this election is between two candidates who, as teenagers, already embodied the traits for which they've become famous, and they probably would not have liked one another. It just might explain why so many voters don't like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump either. It's a story from Lisa Belkin, chief national correspondent at Yahoo News. Lisa, what have you found?
Well, it was certainly an interesting lens. So the number of times that people have described, you know, he's like the jock or like Biff. Actually, did you know he was, that Biff in Back to the Future was based on Donald Trump?
I did not know that until I saw that in your story.
There he is like Biff, and she's, you know, Hermione Granger, and the two of them are running for president. And so I went back and looked at what they did in high school, and frankly, they were essentially the essence of their current selves. And then there's fascinating research out there about what that means to all of us who psychologically and sociologically and anthropologically and all the people who study it tell us that we are all stuck in high school, and how we react to them, interestingly, is probably a product of that.
Wow. All right. So review first, I guess, what they did in high school.
Well, they were what you would have expected. So Trump was, in his yearbook, he was dubbed the ladies' man, and he went to a military academy. He went to New York Military Academy, where his parents sent him, he was quoted as saying, to run off excess energy, basically. They thought it would be good for him because it would sort of calm him down and get him to batten down. And he was, you know, stellar athlete, by others' descriptions, not just his. He was a fabulous baseball player, football player, was looked at by some pro teams for baseball. He also was very much into, you know, the marching, and he won some awards for organization and cleanliness and the sorts of things that are important at military academies. He said over the years that he thought that he has had more military training than some people in the military going to the New York Military Academy, but no shots were ever fired.
Wow.
And then, you know, you have Hillary, who was on every academic team there was. She was on the It's Academic quiz show. She was on the, I think it was called the Cultural Values Committee. She worked on a new school constitution. She was a Goldwater girl. She was an ardent Republican, and she represented the Republican view in the 1964 school presidential debate. You know, and great grades, went to Wellesley, and so the two of them, frankly, would have hated each other in high school.
We're speaking with Lisa Belkin, chief national correspondent at Yahoo News, and her piece is called Nerd Versus Jock, Everything You Need to Know About Clinton and Trump You Learned in High School. So explain a little what you alluded to before, how the way we perceive Clinton and Trump really comes from our own high school experience.
Right. So we were formed in high school. We like to think of ourselves as ever evolving, but we were formed in high school. And based on all sorts of studies that show that the taller you were in high school, the more likely you are to earn more as an adult. And the more overweight you were in high school, the less likely you are to get married as an adult. And basically what we think of ourselves and what we think of other people was formed back then. It was hardened and codified back when, you know, we were 15, 16, 17 years old. And we looked for groups back in high school. That's the way the adolescent brain works, is it wants to find other people like themselves so we can both define ourselves and find our place in the world, and figure that people who are like us are less likely to not like us. And so that's what adolescents do, is they find their groups. And we're still doing that. So you go out into the world as an adult voter, and you are attracted, these sociologists say, to people who are like you or like the version of you that you formed way back when. And you have an aversion to people who are not, or to the people who, you know, knew you were not your peeps back then. And we've got two archetypes here. We've got, you know, the boastful jock, and we have the know-it-all nerd. And frankly, we didn't deal too well with either of those. Back then.
And that's at least in some part, if not a large part, the reason for their unfavorability.
Yeah,
numbers.
Their unfavorables are out the roof, and it's because we just don't, you know, we being the voters in general. Frankly, I was the nerd in high school, but voters in general, like high schoolers in general, you know, tend to not like the people who aren't like them.
Thanks, Lisa. Lisa Belkin, Chief National Correspondent at Yahoo News. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Well, a range of data after the recession and the housing bust supported the idea that only a tiny elite of U.S. society, generally seen as the top 1%, had rebounded and was doing well. But more evidence suggests the economic expansion since the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis has enriched a much larger chunk of the upper middle class. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's not just the top 1% who are getting richer. Part of the middle class is larger and richer than it's ever been. The Wall Street Journal's Josh Zumbrun has more on some new research that shows upper middle class households are growing. So what are we seeing here, Josh?
You know, there's been a lot of concern over the past 5 years that all the growth in the economy was going to just the top 1% of the income distribution. And there's really growing evidence that that's not the case. What's really becoming clear is that upper middle class households, which this particular piece of research defines as just families with six figure incomes, but not they use the cutoff of under $350,000. And what this research really shows is that group of families is doing incredibly well also.
So is it time to redefine who the well-off or the 1% are?
So this particular research looked at, you know, since 1979, which is really, the economy kind of had a big shift in 1979. I mean, it was, you know, right before Reagan came in. It was right before the Federal Reserve kind of took care of the high inflation in the 1970s. And it's also when a lot of these trends about income inequality really took off. So that's the period that it looks at. And over this period, the number of people earning the equivalent of what's $100,000 today has more than doubled. It's gone from about 13% of the population to about 29% of the population. You know, so, you know, people can say that, well, you know, $100,000 isn't really, it's not really enough to be upper middle class. That's something that some people said when I talked about this topic. And that's, you know, maybe that's true, but it's not the case that there were people in the there was a larger group of people in the past that was earning a comparable amount of money to this.
What's the reason for the growth? Anybody pin that down?
Well, so a lot of what looks to be happening here has to do with higher education. I mean, it's overwhelmingly people with college and especially graduate degrees. that are in this group. And so, you know, there's kind of different theories on what's driving that. But one is that technology has kind of just really changed the labor market so that you know, physical skills and things like that are easily done. So technology and kind of trade are two things. I mean, physical skills are more easily done by machines, and they're more easily done in other countries. And then kind of like knowledge, service-type work is much harder to export, and it's much harder to automate. And so there's kind of this big split that's emerged, and it's manifesting itself in really different outcomes for what we think of as the upper middle class and what we think of as the middle and lower middle class.
What about when it comes to the income gap or income inequality? How does the new data put that in perspective?
Well, so there's always been a lot of different ways to look at income inequality. I mean, one thing that people always looked at, well, one thing that a lot of people looked at used to be kind of the gap between like the 1%, the top 1% of incomes, and the median income. And so that showed, you know, that the 1% was doing really well, and the person at the 50th percentile hadn't made much progress. And what this kind of shows is, this doesn't say that that's not true, but what this shows is that if you compared, say, the 50th percentile, that person in the very middle, to someone at the 90th percentile, kind of someone squarely in the middle class, you'd see a lot of rising inequality there. That person at the 90th is doing very well, and it's still the case that that person at the 50th hasn't really seen much progress in the past, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. You know, the 1% are still extremely well off. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, we used to hear this refrain about the 99%, and it was this idea that the entire rest of the country is not doing well. And it's really just, you know, actually 3 or 4 years ago, that was possible that was going to be the case. I mean, it's not that people were lying back then. What's happened is that as more and more data have come in, if we started to see how this recovery has unfolded, we've started to see a much broader group of people that are also doing very well. And it's the group we traditionally think of as upper middle class, working professionals, college educations or graduate degrees often, and just starting to really completely catch up from everything that was lost in the recovery and sort of set new records in that group as well.
Wall Street Journal's Josh Zumbrun with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. In the never-ending race to create the world's most impractical fashion trend, a new entrant is hitting the streets, the all-white designer sneaker. Not only that, Wall Street Journal fashion writer Christina Binkley says with the white shoe boom has come the boom in white shoe resuscitation techniques. Christina, what's with this?
You know, it's a remarkable how many $1,000 pairs of sneakers are almost indistinguishable from those old Adidas Stan Smiths that have been around since 1971. They really, I mean, they're using materials. Tom Ford has a pair that he made in Python. I think those are $2,300 roughly. And there's lots of them at the sort of the $500 to $800 realm that are made out of leather. But they really are based on these sneakers that were designed in the late 1960s, and they're not bringing a lot new to the shape. It's just the concept of it being a designer sneaker as opposed to a piece of athletic wear.
Jeez, I was just thinking as I'm my mind is blown by the numbers in terms of dollar figures on these sneakers. What is it that you and I could design to sell to the rich people who are going to pay $2,500 for a pair of tennis sneakers? There's got to be something we can do.
I think that's why you and I are doing what we do,
yeah.
And that's what they
yeah.
are doing what they do.
I mean, even the Saint Laurent, right? $545 for a pair of sneakers. This is unfathomable to me. And so explain, I guess, because it's almost like a cottage industry now of how to clean these things.
Well, I was amazed by the number of tips that people have come up with to keep them clean. And the one that I heard over and over and over is those Mr. Clean Magic Erasers. I use them in my house on my walls because they're great at getting smudges off walls that my kids put on them. I hadn't thought about using them on footwear, but I will now. Apparently, if you just damp the Magic Eraser and sort of go along the white heel of a sneaker, it takes the smudges off and doesn't damage the leather. So there you go. Tide sticks. seem to be another real popular one. Baby wipes, and I was told if you want to clean your sneakers with baby wipes, make sure you use the baby wipes with the chemicals. Don't use the all-natural ones you get at the health food store.
Oh, yeah. Who wants that all-natural nonsense, right? Give me the good chemicals to clean these shoes. Who was the guy, too? He's got some routine, right? He's dipping his sneakers three times in a Scotch Guard or something, right?
You know, I somehow thought Scotch Guard, I didn't even know it still existed. That stuff is so toxic. But yes, he said you take the sneakers, you literally just dip it into the Scotch Guard. He can't possibly mean that. You wouldn't have a bucket. So he means three good solid sprays. But you do it three times and you let it dry in between. So basically you've got a permanent coating covering the sneakers.
Oh, but that's not enough, right? Because he's got to use the toothpaste to clean the bottom.
Yes, the whitening toothpaste, and he says the higher the fluoride content, the better.
All right, so who's wearing these all white sneakers these days?
Do you know what? These are huge sellers. When you talk to at the luxury department stores, this is one of the most profitable departments in the department stores right now are these sneaker departments that are really, so they truly are selling. They're on all kinds of celebrities. At one point I was helping some people look for photographs of these to run with a story, and we just went to Getty Images and I typed in white sneakers celebrity, and my screen just filled up.
Really?
It just blew up with photographs of celebrities running all over the place wearing them. Channing Tatum was one of the top hits, but you know, this is a trend that's it's both for men and for women, so you know that just helps the sales. You've got both genders buying into these big time.
Thanks, Christina. Wall Street Journal fashion writer Christina Binkley. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit Barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to the state that went from 49th to 10th best in corporate business income tax, where 2,000 burdensome and unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the last 5 years, and is now home to the 6th best entrepreneurial climate. All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. MichiganBusiness.org. Anybody ever tell you at a graduation ceremony of some kind to follow your passion? It's common advice from many commencement speakers these days. Google says searches on that topic are more popular than ever. But some experts, as well as those who've tried it, say doing this can be tricky when it comes to your career. MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill has a couple of reasons why. Katie, what have you found?
So I was looking at graduation speeches throughout the country, what people were saying, and the term follow your passion kept coming up. I asked Google to search for me, like, what's going on? What is the trending terms here? Follow your passion has just shot up in terms of Google searches. So this is obviously quite a popular piece of advice for graduates. You know, here, follow your passion when you're looking for your career. Google even shows it in its trend results. If you look at data on how much it appears in books, it's the same thing. It's really just shot up in popularity.
Wow. All right. So maybe we should tweak it to follow your passion until you're old enough to get a real job? Is that?
I mean, I actually kind of think that might be better, slightly better advice. I talked to people both who did this, who said, well, I followed my passion. And some of them, of course, were like, it was great, it worked out. Others said, that didn't really work out well for me. I talked to one woman who, she majored in marine biology. She thought that this is what she really wanted to do. She found out that it was very lonely, and she's a very social person. So she realized, you know, having a passion for the topic doesn't really mean you're going to like working in that field. She actually left and became a financial advisor because she realized, I really just want to be talking and working with people all the time. And she was just working with fish, and it didn't really suit her personality at all. So now she goes on vacation and goes snorkeling and does all that. But she said as a career, that it was not for her.
Very good. How about the fact you just might not be good at it if this passion of yours?
Yeah, I mean, I think many an American Idol contestant can tell you that although you may be passionate about singing or whatever you're passionate about, you really might not be good at it. And that's, I mean, that's one of the biggest things, right? You could follow your passion, but you also have to follow a passion that you have a skill in, at least if you want to make that as your career. And by the way, it's fine to just make it as your hobby, and that's what you do, but you gotta, you know, you can't just think if you, just because you like something, you're going to be good at it and be able to make money at it. That's not really the reality here.
Well, we're speaking with MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill. Her piece is called "This Popular Career Advice May Leave You Poor and Regretful." All right, so what else?
The biggest one, I think, here is that you might just not be able to support yourself on your passion. I mean, there's millions of people who love crafting, you know, but when you look at data, the pay is not very good. There's not many jobs in that. And that's true of so many industries that people say they're passionate about. I mean, so many more people say they're passionate about arts and music and sports than they do, you know, science and engineering, even though those are tend to be more jobs, they pay better. So you do have to think about, can you really support yourself on that? And that's fine. This could just be your B, you know, your B career. Maybe you just sell a few things on Etsy, but it's not actually what supports you, and that's fine. But you do have to kind of realize that, you know, going into this, that this may never be the thing that supports you.
Thanks, Katie. MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill, who's based in New York. It is 22 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. On the tech front, why does South Korea consistently get better and faster performance from its smartphones than the U.S.? It's a question explored by tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. Rob, what led you to do this?
We've got a new technology being released by Qualcomm, and phones are being manufactured with it. It's their new Snapdragon X12 LTE modem, and it's three times faster than the modems that we the fastest modems we currently have. But only Korea has the network in place to actually use them, and they'll be followed by other parts of Asia. China's really close behind, and actually already started deploying. So by this time, say late July, August, much of China will also have this capability. We don't yet. Some of the bet is that maybe T-Mobile may roll it out first. But we tend to lag on the technology. And the reason that China and Korea are really aggressive with this is because, well, they basically want to take the tech market from the U.S. And so the government's fully behind the deployment of the centralized radios and towers that's needed to handle these new radios. In the U.S., it's all carried by the carriers. And the carriers just aren't really all that willing to invest on the cutting edge stuff. In fact, they're mostly just dealing with the fact that they don't have enough radios to cover their capacity in many cases. So the end result is that Korea and China are going to get these things first, maybe up to a year before we do. And I kind of think that's a shame. One, because it allows them to get all the benefits of the technology before we do. But number two, it really starts putting China and Korea in the leadership position and with regard to technology, which is a market that we pretty much owned for decades. So it's just another weakness in our overall focus on keeping our businesses at the forefront.
Right. And the real issue, if I understand it right, is upload versus download.
Right. What this really does is increase dramatically your upload speed. You know, people are taking pictures, they're taking video, they're uploading and sharing it, and it's that 3x speed increases which you're going to see mostly for the upload. Download, we're pretty good, but we still have limitations. But on the upload side, against these Asian countries, we're not competitive, or at least we won't be by the end of the year.
And why not? Is that in China? Is it just government money being thrown at it? Is that the advantage?
Yeah,
there?
You know, the carriers are pretty much owned by the government in China, and they're subsidized by the government in Korea. So you get a lot of government support driving the technology push, because the government recognizes that it's incredibly important for Asia that Asia takes over the lead for technology, that much like Japan did with consumer electronics a couple decades back and almost did with cars. In fact, some might argue they actually did it with cars. The government recognizes that it's incredibly important that this leadership position reside with them, and they're more than happy to take it from us.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's got an interesting piece entitled "Next Generation Smartphones Are Wickedly Fast. Why Does Korea Get Them First?" All right, so explain, too, because we used to lead in a bunch of other categories, right? But we've dropped the ball on this one.
Well, Well, yeah, you know, we controlled the world's oil at one time, and then we broke up Standard Oil and lost that leadership. We controlled consumer electronics largely through RCA early on, and we broke up RCA and put them out of business. And then, of course, for automotive, the Japanese came over, learned how we did things, then ended up doing them often better than we did, and we ended up losing leadership in cars. And we owned trains, too. Trains, we were the leader in trains coming into this century. And, of course, now if you look at where the most advanced trains are, they're in Japan, China, and places like Korea. The most advanced train currently in the world is the Maglev train. In China, it was a technology that was showcased here early on, but we never deployed or never rolled out a Maglev train ourselves. That it happened in China first. And I'm almost willing to bet with Hyperloop, which of course is being developed by Elon Musk here, that China will likely be the first. China or Japan will be likely to be the first to have a Hyperloop train. Even though, you know, here on the West Coast, we are developing a fast train. We're using technology that's probably about 35 years out of date. So it's just really kind of sad.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. 14 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. The 4th of July is the biggest grilling day of the year, right? Spotlight on your skills on Monday. To help backyard chefs prepare an epic menu, Great American Barbecue Tour host Mike Peters is here to share his grilling expertise. Mike, tell us about what you call the gospel of Q.
You know what? You can literally do everything on a grill. Ceramics, you can bake, you can smoke, you can roast, you can do a little bit of everything on the grill. But it's the bigger part of barbecue and grilling is you're doing it typically with people that you love,
family
and friends, around an open fire, and it doesn't get any better than that.
Which means the margin for error is much greater. You have much more leeway or forgiveness when it's family and friends, right?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, a lot of people try to cook too hot and too fast, or everybody's in a hurry. And grilling is the time to just slow down and grill. Slow down and chill, slow down and grill. Lower heat is definitely more forgiving, and it allows you to spend some time doing things with the people you love.
I use a gas grill. Do you still find reason to have a conversation with me, or am I dismissed?
You know what? We can change that. Give me time. But a lot of people have gas grills. Turn the knob on the top, and you hit a button, and you're good to go. That's okay. It's still a flame, and it's still food. So it's okay. I don't mind it at all. And you can get some of the great smoky flavor out of a gas grill as what I can when I use the hardwood lump charcoal. Wood chips. Soaked down in water, wood chips, and wrapped up in a little aluminum foil burrito is like I like to call it.
Oh.
Poke some holes in it, throw that right on top of the grill. It's going to give you some nice smoky flavor.
How about that? What's the biggest mistake, Mike, that you find most of us make?
Cooking on hot, too high a heat. Everybody wants it on 10 because they want it now. They don't want to wait and wait for to let the heat do the thing, its own thing to the meat, so to speak. They want it now, and so too high heat is the biggest mistake that I see people do. Turn on medium to low heat and just let it go a little bit longer. It'll help get that heat into the proteins, whether it's chicken or steaks or whatever. And I guess steaks, because it's a beef, is a thicker protein, a thicker muscle-wise, higher heat isn't going to affect it as much, just a little bit shorter time. So, but chicken, pork, definitely a little bit medium heat would be great. I'm with you there, and there's a lot of good temperature guides or temperature alarm pieces, gadgets to help you with that process anymore. There's amazing the things that are out there.
When you and your wife get invited to the neighbor's house for a barbecue, do you have a hard time, or does your wife have a hard time not taking over? You are a champion barbecue pit master. That's serious.
All of our neighbors know by now when we pull a 40-foot gooseneck trailer that's all branded out, labeled out, has all the sponsors on it. When we get home, they know we're there. So we'll usually get calls. Normally they know we're coming from a barbecue, so we're bringing home leftovers, and we don't eat barbecue anymore. It goes all to the neighbors.
That's funny.
If we get invited over on a spare weekend off, we bring the sides. So we'll bring a potato salad, or we'll bring extra condiments, things like that. We'll bring the sides to do. Let them be the grill master at their own house. And I try to bite my tongue, and and all of our neighbors pretty well now are pretty well-versed.
Thanks, Mike. Mike Peters, Great American Barbecue Tour host. It is 6 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. Well, from the folks at Map Happy, here are three little-known ways you can get airlines to bend the rules if you're calm about it. Number one, the flat tire rule. This gives check-in agents some flexibility to accommodate you if you missed your flight because of, say, a flat tire on the way to the airport. Realize it doesn't need to be an actual flat tire and it doesn't require any ridiculous documentation. Number two, the trip in vain rule. You're scheduled to be in Denver for a 2 o'clock meeting. When you connect in Chicago, you're delayed. You're now not getting to Denver till 6, 4 hours later. Under this rule, you're entitled to a refund, credit, change, or compensation because the purpose of the trip is now shot. Finally, the most direct routing rule. This is bound to happen during a snowstorm when you get rerouted through a series of hubs, but each traveler is entitled to ask the airport for the most direct routing. Now, most gate agents won't necessarily volunteer this information, but you need to know how to ask. Our travel update has been brought to you by Lexington Hotels. At Lexington Inns and Hotels, our highest priority is providing you with exceptional service at a great rate. Visit LexingtonHotels.com for reservations and locations. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.